Philip Pettit is the Lawrence S. Rockefeller University Professor of Politics and Human Values at Princeton University. I'm sure he's very well known to all of you. He was elected Fellow of the American Academy of Arts and Sciences in 2009 and honorary member of the Royal Irish Academy in 2010. He's also a Fellow of the Australian Academies in Humanities and Social Sciences. Philip holds honorary professorships in philosophy at Sydney University and Queen's University in Belfast. And in 2010, he won the prestigious Guggenheim Fellowship and is spending this academic year as a Fellow at the Centre for Advanced Study in Behavioural and Social Sciences at Stanford University. Philip is one of the world's leading authors in moral and political theory and has made important contributions to issues in the philosophy of mind and metaphysics. He's a prodigious writer. He has a new book out with Christian List with OUP, called Group Agency, and he's written many, many other books. In fact, one of the requirements of the UHERO lecturer is to write a short book on the basis of his lectures. And Philip said, well, I'm really happy to give the lectures, but I actually have three books that I have to write before I can write your book. But knowing his productivity, we're very happy to agree with that arrangement, and we're looking forward to the book. And we welcome you to give the first lecture tonight, Robust Demands and the Need for Virtue.
Julian, it's awful to have one's white lies repeated in public. it's really a great pleasure to be here, and a great honour to be giving the OHERO lectures. And let me express my gratitude to the OHERO Foundation and the OHERO Centre for inviting me on this occasion. So the title isn't exactly transparent. Making good. The contrast is with doing good, and hopefully in the course of the lectures, the contrast will become slightly more transparent than it is now. I'm going to talk in this first lecture about one category of what I describe as robustly demanding values or goods, or if you prefer, modally demanding values or goods. And in the next lecture tomorrow, I'm going to talk about quite a different category that of robustly demanding goods. I think that these values or goods are particularly important, and I don't think they've been sufficiently, as were, isolated and identified and focused upon within moral and political theory. So that's the rationale for lecturing on this topic. And then on Friday, I'm going to give a more general set of reflections on these values and on their significance in thinking about methodology in ethics, in particular questions to do with consequentialism and non-consequentialism. Okay, so just to introduce the... And everybody, I take it, has a handout which will give you a sort of guide to at least where I'm supposed to be going by my own direction, whether I stick to the plan. Well, I intend to stick to the plan, so let's hope I succeed in that. Robustly demanding goods. In order to introduce the category, maybe a little bit of reminding you of debates in parallel fields may be useful. So, for example, we've now come to recognize very clearly, because of the many debates around that, the difference between objectively demanding goods versus subjectively demanding goods. Now, goods that are only subjectively demanding are the sorts of goods that you could enjoy while within Robert Nozick's experience machine. Do you remember in the Nozick experience machine as he imagined it? It was an apparatus you entered, and, you know, depending on how you turned the dial, you could have an experience as of being someone famous, as of being someone beautiful and loved, as of being a celebrity, whatever. You could have any experience you wished. It would all be with you subjectively, as if objectively you did enjoy the celebrity or whatever it might be that you wanted. But, of course, that would just give a purely subjective good, in the sense that you enjoy that good doesn't require that the objective world outside you be any way at all. It's not an objectively demanding good, the goods you might enjoy in such an apparatus. Objectively demanding goods, for example, like achievement or whatever I said here, peace, requires not just that it's a certain way in your sensorium, as it were, subjectively with you, but that things are a certain way in the world. Okay, so that's a clear contrast. Some values or goods require the world to be thus and so, and not just subjective experience to be thus and so. And we've all learned, I guess, to, at least some of us think we have learned, that values that are worth thinking about are almost all objectively demanding. They're not merely subjectively demanding values. Of course, hedonic utilitarians, I guess, and there may be some even in our midst today, would think otherwise on that issue. Now, apart from that contrast between objectively and subjectively demanding goods, there's also a perhaps lesser known contrast between goods that are diachronically demanding versus goods that are not. Goods that are not diachronically demanding are the sorts of goods such that enjoying them in the present, in the here and now, doesn't require the past to have been any way at all and doesn't require the future to be any way at all. But many goods, of course, are diachronically demanding. So, for example, to enjoy the good of having someone keep their promise to you, to enjoy the promise-keeping of another person, is to enjoy a diachronically demanding good, because that good wouldn't be there to be enjoyed unless the past had been a certain way, unless that person had actually made a promise. You can only enjoy that good if the past is a certain way. Presentist goods, so to speak, goods that are not diachronically demanding, are going to be a much narrower category. Now, and of course, we're all familiar with, you know, the three dimensions that go subjective, objective, temporally present, and temporally extended. And the third one, familiar to all of us in philosophy, is the dimension as between the how things actually are and how things could be, how things are in the actual world versus how things are in various possible worlds. Now, unlikely as it may seem, I want to say that there are some really important values which are demanding across possible worlds. Okay, that's pretty dark as a phrase, so let me explain what I mean. Something you enjoy might require that things are thus and so in the actual world. Fine, I'll be talking about many such, let's call them actualist goods. They correspond with subjective goods, or purely presentist goods. Purely actualist goods are going to be equally relatively weak in this dimension. And by contrast with purely actualist goods, are goods such that you only enjoy them in the actual world if certain things are thus and so in various possible worlds. That's to say, under various possible scenarios, under various different eventualities. Again, that's going to seem fairly dark, I think, but let me go straight into the lecture, and I think you'll see what I mean in describing some goods as being robustly or modally demanding. But I just wanted to set that up. I'll come back to this in the third lecture, because I think there's a structure there that's really important. So just to give you the structure again, some goods are thin, so to speak, on the subjective dimension, and then others are objectively demanding. They are richer in that dimension. Some goods are thin on the temporal dimension, requiring things to be thus and so just in the present. Others are richer, requiring things to have been thus and so in the past or thus and so in the future. And equally, I want to say, some goods are thin in the modal dimension, as we call it. They require things to be thus and so in the actual world, but others are much richer. In order to have them, they require that things be a certain way under various possible scenarios, as we say, in various possible worlds. So in order to introduce the idea and this first category of robustly demanding goods that I'll be talking about today, let me go to, well, it's actually the very opposite end on the spectrum of the austere versus the, you know, the rich and dense and lively. So let me talk about love and friendship, because I actually think that there are values involved here that are robustly demanding in the sense that I'll be explaining. So as I say here, suppose that you, arbitrarily, you are my friend or my lover, and someone I'm attached to and who's attached to me in particular. And now what do I expect from such a friend? Well, of course, one thing you expect is that the friend gives you a certain care, has a certain concern for you, displays that concern or care for you. Now, care in that sense is what I call an actualist good. In order to enjoy actually the care of the other person, things just have to be actually thus and so. They have to display that care in this, the way things actually are. And that's fine. So that's certainly a necessary part of somebody's being your friend or your lover, that they display this actual care. But if you're my friend or my lover, it's important, you won't count as my friend or my lover, unless you display that care, not just precisely as things actually are, but also you must display that care under various possibilities. So, for example, were I to grow somewhat older, as undoubtedly I will, if you're my friend or my lover, the care should remain robust across that change in me, whereby I grow older. If I lose even more of my hair, the care or the affection should still remain in place. In order for you to be my friend or my lover, the attachment to me ought to mean that you actually care for me, and it ought to mean that you would care for me, as we say, even did I have less hair, did I grow older, did I grow fatter, were I 64, again. It's got to be robust, as we say. Imagine me as I actually am, and now imagine various changes that are possible. They represent ways things might be. They represent what we call in philosophy possible worlds, possible scenarios. Now, it has to be the case if actually you are my friend, is that, of course, actually you care for me, but it has to be the case that that care is robust across those possible changes. It has to mean that that care is available just as I am and just as I might be across a whole range, as I say, of possibilities. Of course, this hasn't been lost on the great thinkers. So think of, you know, that wonderful line and a half from the Shakespearean sonnet where he says, "Love is not love which alters when it alteration finds." You thought I'd forgotten the line. I agree that. Okay, love is not love which alters when it alteration finds. The idea is if it's love, there's care, of course, actually. But it doesn't cease to be caring when it alteration finds, when the object of the love, you know, me in the example I've been talking about, changes in various ways. It still remains caring. And that's what it is to enjoy love. Actually, Oscar Wilde, in a rather more jocose style, brings out the lesson wonderfully well in the play The Importance of Being Earnest. You remember in that play, actually, there are two couples. There's Jack, and there's Gwendolyn, and there's, what's his name, Algernon, and Cecily. And in each case, the woman is devoted to the man, as he is to her. They've, in fact, just fallen in love, or at least just announced their love, or developed their love. And in each case, the woman believes that the man is called Ernest. In each case, indeed, she explains what a wonderful name it is, and so on. And disturbed in each case, in fact, well, let's just stick with Jack and Gwendolyn. Jack says to Gwendolyn, "But, I mean, couldn't you love me if I were called Jack?" To which Gwendolyn responds, "Oh, no," she says. Whether you've seen that 1950s movie with Joan, playing in the part, a wonderful part. She says, "Oh, no," she says, I always thought Ernest is such a wonderfully reassuring name. I've always known I could never love a man who was not called Ernest." Ernest. Now, as a matter of fact, of course, what's really funny about the play, of course, I mean, there are levels I'm not going to unfold here in the plot and in the way Wilde builds it up so wonderfully, but the crucial point is that it's just simply ridiculous that someone, in this case Gwendolyn, should claim to love this man, but the love is contingent on his name remaining as it is, right? So what she's saying is that her care for him will not be robust across the change whereby he gets another name or he's called by a different name. That seems utterly absurd. So the idea is, what I'm trying to bring out here, is that in our very conception of love, and I would say the same is true clearly, I say, of friendship, in our conception of that, care, actual care, is clearly involved, but for it to count as love or friendship, the care has got to be robust across changes such as a change in name or a change in hairline or whatever it might be. In fact, what I've said now is that it must be robust, that may be the subject, the object of the love or the friendship again, it has to be robust across changes in me, like the change in name. But equally, if you think someone is a lover or a friend, you've got to think that their care for you, their concern for you, as they display it behaviorally, that it's got to also be robust across certain changes in them. So, for example, you've got to expect that they will continue to care for you and give you care, even as it becomes just a little bit more bothersome, for example, to do it. Even as it becomes, let's say, unprofitable to do it. I mean, it may be as it is that it's really, as it were, serves their self-interest to give you care. But if you think they're a friend or a lover, you've got to think that that care is robust across changes whereby it becomes less interested on their part, less profitable on their part. So the idea is that for love or friendship to be present, you've got to have an actualist good, as I call it, a good that makes no demands on how things might be, just on how things are. And that actualist good, let's call it care, you've got to have that. But that good has got to be available if you're to enjoy actually love. If I'm to enjoy actually love, I've got to enjoy actualist care, and I've got to enjoy care across various ways things might be, across various changes possible in me, and across various changes possible in the person, so to speak, delivering the care. Now, and these are really using the terms, I think, as terms of art, you might call the first virtue of love, our friendship, the virtue whereby it remains steadfast, robust, across changes in the object of the love. You might call that actually, these really are terms of art, because I think they, I can kind of quite remember exactly how I chose to use them. But I think that over changes in me, yes, you talk about the person remaining faithful, right? They're faithful to you even as you get to be 64, even as you get to have the hairline change, even as you get to be poorer and more curmudgeonly or whatever. And it's loyalty, it's a loyal sort of care insofar as it's robust across changes in the person themselves. So what we require for love and friendship is that the care is both faithful, meaning steadfast across changes in the object of the love, and loyal, meaning steadfast or robust across changes in the giver of the love. Of course, it's reciprocal, but I'm abstracting from that particular complexity here. Of course, one question now that immediately arises is, wait a moment, to say that it's robust across various ways things might be isn't to say anything about the ways things might be over which we require it to be robust. Okay, this is going to be the last of my jokes, actually, I think, but there is a well-known joke about friendship which brings out the point nicely. Do you know the joke that goes, a good friend will help you move an apartment? And you think, right, you know, so should you make a new demand on this? That's a change in you, in a way. Could you help me move the apartment? And the person said, well, maybe, you know, I'll see if I've got anything better to do and so on. Well, you know straight away that isn't a friend. You know, a good friend may talk to you about when the best time is, when he or she may help you, but certainly a good friend will help you move an apartment. And the joke then continues, a very good friend will help you move a body. And you think, and obviously the idea is, presuming that asking a friend to help you move a body means that you've done, at least the assumption is, something criminal. And so in asking the friend to help you move a body, what you're saying, well, now there's a big change in me. You know, I've just turned into a mafia gunman or whatever it might be, and I'm sort of helping you to, and tell you about this side of my life, you know, or maybe I've just become that sort of person. And of course, we don't expect that a friend, should indeed continue to deliver care across that sort of change, across the help you move the body change, but across the help you move the department change, for sure. So that shows that we don't expect the care to be robust across all possible changes, either in the object of the love, which is what I've been illustrating, but equally, I think, in the giver of the love, so to speak. Were the giver to change, were it to be a matter of, you know, suicidal devotion for him or her to give you care in a certain circumstance, then you would think friendship does not require that. Maybe even love does not require that. And of course, it's a measure of love, as in greater love, etc. And no one has, then blah, blah. I won't push that further, but you know the reference. I mean, it's a measure of how deep love is, presumably as to how many sort of variations it will remain steadfast over. But in the ordinary sense of friendship and love, clearly we do not require it to remain steadfast or stable across all changes. So then the question is, well, what changes? We don't. It's not enough that it just is there in the actual world, and it's too much to think that it's there in all possible, under possible variations. So how do you sort of restrict the variations under which you expect the care to be robust or steadfast in order to constitute love? Well, one natural response is to say, well, what you really want is this. You want the care to be there with greater certainty or whatever, to the extent to which the variation in question is a likely variation or a probable variation, to the extent to which it's a change that is very likely to happen. Okay, so how does that seem to you? It's worth thinking about. Because if that's what it is, of course, then enjoying the friendship of someone is enjoying their being disposed to maximize expected care vis-a-vis you. That is to say, to act in such a way that, to the extent to which a possibility is probable, to that extent you have better grounds for expecting the care to be present, and to the extent to which variation is improbable, to that extent you haven't a ground for expecting it to be there. Now, it doesn't actually take much reflection to realize that that can't be it either. It can't be that it's just the probable variations under which the care remains available, scaled to the probability. And the Oscar Wilde example tells you straight away. I mean, if we do require of someone we count as a lover or a friend that they should remain caring of you across a variation in your name, and we surely do require that, we'd have known that even if Oscar Wilde hadn't made it so vivid for us, then you've got to realize the possibility under which my name changes is extraordinarily improbable. After all, it would require a very improbable event of, I suppose you can get a name change by going to a notary or whatever, would require that things were different from how they actually were back then when your parents gave you a name. So far as we require the care to be steadfast, it's not just in the actual world, you know, but neither is it just in the probable worlds, because here is a very improbable world in which we require it to remain steadfast. So back to my question. If care has to remain steadfast or robust across variations in order to count as friendship or love, variations in you and variations in the person giving the care, how are we going to demarcate the possible worlds? Now at this point, those of you who do epistemology, in particular those of you who sat at Tim Williamson's feet, will begin to recognize an analogy with knowledge and true belief, though that's not quite how Tim puts it. Because, of course, there's a debate in that area too. If you're said to know something, then as, this is the way I prefer to put it, it's not quite Tim's Williamson's way of putting it, but it's to have evidence that rules, if you know that P, it's to have evidence that rules out not P across a range of possible worlds, the relevant possible worlds, as we say, across relevant scenarios. It's got to be the sort of person who, if they believe that P, then it's going to be the case that P, because their evidence is going to rule out not P. And equally, and the thing that Tim Williamson says, of course, about that range of possible worlds where you're required, as he puts it, not to believe falsely that P, if you're going to know that P back in the actual world, as he says about that range of worlds, it's not all possible worlds, and it's not just the probable worlds, and there probably isn't any non-circular way of defining the range of possible worlds. I guess his idea is that if you know what knowledge is, you know what's required of someone who is to count as a knower. You know about what's required in terms of they're not falsely believing things, the variation under which they should still remain not falsely believing the things they know. Sorry, the opposite of what they know. Now, actually, the points, I shouldn't perhaps even have mentioned that, except it's nice to make connections across different areas of philosophy, I always think. It gives a sort of sideways light, you know. Anyhow, back to the original case. What possibilities is your care required to remain steadfast over in order for it to be the care of a lover or a friend? And I think the only answer I can give at the moment, I mean, if anyone has an idea of a different answer, I would just love to hear it, is that someone who knows what friendship is, you know, when you know what friendship is, you know, as it were, the possibilities where a failure to deliver care would be a sign that this isn't a friend. And you know the possibilities where a failure to deliver care would not mean that it's not a friend. So, for example, none of us expects of a friend that he or she should continue to deliver care even if you became a truly callous or awful person, you know, if you lost whatever, so to speak, virtues you had. That isn't an expectation, so to speak, of friendship. So I think it's probably just that we know those possibilities, the range in question, just by knowing what friendship is. That, at any rate, is the best that I can do at the moment. So if this line of thought so far is at all persuasive, what it shows is that we have, associated with either love or friendship, there are two virtues, goods, I should say, for the moment, that friends or lovers give us. One, let's call it fidelity, which is a steadfast care across changes in you, and the other is loyalty, which is a steadfast care across changes in them, where the changes over which the care has to remain steadfast or robust are changes that we can't really pin down in an exact way independently of an understanding of what friendship or love involves. Okay, so if you'll come with me that far, what I now want to do is go on to the question of what makes these, if this is right, these are just two examples. There are many more, as I'll want to suggest at the end of the lecture, which is just about 25 minutes away, if you can bear with me. So what makes a robustly demanding good like loyalty or fidelity so attractive to us? Well, one question you want to ask straight away is this. In desiring fidelity or loyalty in my friend, I desire, given what I've said, I desire that things be thus and so, not just in the actual world when they give me care, but I desire that things be thus and so in various, under various possible variations where things are different, tougher for them, or where I'm less charming, or whatever. So I'm actually requiring and desiring, therefore, things to be thus and so in various non-actual worlds. Now, that raises a Euthyphro question. You remember the Euthyphro question raised by Socrates, which is whether the gods love what is holy because it's holy, or whether what makes it holy is that the gods love it. There's a Euthyphro question here too, which is, do I desire fidelity in the actual world or loyalty in the actual world because I really want things to be thus and so in those possible worlds? You know, I've got a real... I live out there in these possibilities, you know, and I really think about them, and I want things to be there thus and so in those cases, and I realize they'll be thus and so in those cases only if this guy back here is loyal or faithful. So I want the loyalty or fidelity because I want the non-actual care. The actual loyalty, fidelity is desirable because the non-actual care, the care in those possibilities, is desirable. But that seems all wrong. I mean, it seems much more plausible to say, I mean, why would I have concern about possibilities just in the abstract? What I'm concerned about always is, of course, the actual world, right? So what I want to say, the obvious answer to that question is that I care about the person being a loyal or a faithful friend or lover. That's what I care about. I want that relationship with that person. And it's because of wanting this relationship, since it requires that they give care, not just actually, but as things might be across various changes, it's because of wanting that that loyalty and fidelity that I want things to be thus and so in the actual world. So the euthyphronic direction is, so to speak, is perfectly, I think, plausible here. I mean, just as we think it's more plausible to say, at least most of us think it's more plausible to say that the gods love the holy because it's holy, independently of their loving it. And they love it because it's holy. It isn't made holy by their loving it. Similarly, love, fidelity or loyalty isn't made desirable by the desirability of those non-actual possibilities, by the care in those scenarios. It's rather the other way around. I do care about those scenarios. That's why Algernon was really, or Jack, was really worried about Gwendolyn's not caring for him. Should he be called by a different name? Again, I'm ignoring some details about the actual play. He's worried about that, but he's only worried about it because he wants her love. Right? And he realizes he doesn't have it if he doesn't have that. So that's the directional thing. So we go the normal way. But then another question that arises, well, why do I want loyalty and fidelity? I mean, you know, it's perfectly clear, possibly, by assumption, it's perfectly clear why I want care. Care is nice. You know, it strokes you down, it makes you feel, you know, blah, blah. I mean, there's no question about why care matters. Why do I want this extra thing, you know, fidelity or loyalty, this much richer thing than mere care? It seems like maybe it's overreaching. What is it that makes it something that obviously we deeply hanker after in this case? Well, maybe back up a little bit. In wanting someone to be loyal or friendly, what I want them in the, you know, relevant dimensions or whatever, is to be of goodwill towards me, to have a will towards me, a caring will, that, as we say, is a goodwill. And I take it that it's only a goodwill, it's only loyalty or friendship, insofar as it's not going to be thrown off just by incentives or temptations that like move the person to go in a different direction. So now the question is, why do I want that sort of goodwill in another person? And I actually think that this takes us to, I sort of find the murky waters, and I like to think they're deep waters because they're murky waters, but I think they are quite deep issues, actually, as to why we should care about that sort of goodwill. That's to say, a robustly present goodwill. I mean, a goodwill that delivers robust care across various possibilities. And let me just give you some thoughts as to why I think we do care about that. In order to set up the thought, imagine a slightly different scenario. Imagine I'm extremely wealthy. I mean, really very well. I'm so wealthy. I'm like one of these, you know, Wall Street CEOs, hedge fund manager. I mean, I've got wealth that is going to see me and my progeny through for generations, right? Billions. And now here's someone, right, who cares for me in the actual world, right? Well, now my wealth is, you know, pretty robust. I mean, as in an awful lot of very, 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 very bad and very, very unlikely things would have to happen for me to become, you know, just like an ordinary person, let alone become poor. So my wealth is very, very robust. And so you might think, imagine now a person who cares for me, who gives me this care, which we agree is worth wanting. This person gives me this care in the actual world, and now we look at various possible worlds, maybe a whole range of possible worlds, and we think, well, that care is going to be pretty, you know, pretty steadfast, because after all, you know, it's really quite nice to have a very wealthy friend, you know, especially if it's also a generous friend, then you can assume that I'm a wealthy and generous friend. I mean, they want to keep giving me care in all sorts of possibilities. So why shouldn't I be happy with that? Why do I want this other thing, this really, you know, ratcheted in, as it were, goodwill on the part of the other person? And here's what I think is the answer. When we, let me take you back to Peter Strawson's Freedom and Resentment, a paper which I'm sure you all know. And you remember his line used to be that it's part and parcel of human relations that we feel gratitude or resentment towards other people when they behave well or badly towards us. We feel indignation and approval if they behave well or badly towards other, towards third parties. And in particular, we continue to feel these attitudes even as they, the people, that is to say, continue, let's say, to behave badly. We continue to feel those attitudes even as it becomes almost, you know, it's clear this isn't a person who they say they, you know, care about other people, I suppose, but they don't actually display it very much in evidence. But we keep thinking, I still feel resentful towards him. I still feel indignant at how he's behaving. Now, just think about what's involved in thinking that. But what's involved in thinking that is that even though the person has been behaved very badly time and time and time again, I've never just resigned myself to his behaving like that or her behaving like that, as if it were, so to speak, a fait accompli. I continue to think they could do better. Because if I didn't think that, why would I feel resentment about how they actually behaved? Wouldn't I just adopt something close to what Peter Strawson called the objective stance, where you become utterly resigned? You know, it's just a sort of, he's a force of nature. You know, it just behaves thus and so without any, so to speak, capacity to behave differently. No, as I feel resentment, or indeed gratitude, I keep thinking of this agent as someone who, for relevant options like help someone, hurt someone, is capable of either, even as the record of performance is always don't help, don't help, don't help. I still think this person can help. That's to say, I keep ascribing a capacity to respond to that consideration, even in defiance of the actual inductive evidence, up to the point where I think this person really is just a subject for treatment. This person really is just worthy of the objective stance approach. Now, to the extent to which I think of another agent from within, let's call it, reactive attitudes of that kind, I continue to ascribe to such agents a will, a capacity to choose one way or the other. Even when I think it's very likely, going past record, they'll choose X, they'll choose the not helping option. I still think, if I still maintain the reactive attitude to them, I'm maintaining the view they could help. That's a capacity that they have. Now, I think that, I call that phenomenon the agential idealization. I think when we think of an agent and treat other people as agents and continue to get angry with them as they do badly, or, you know, indeed the other way around too, but the negative one brings it out more nicely, as we do that, then what we're thinking is we're idealizing their capacities. We're thinking of them as being able to do X or do Y, regardless of the experience. This is an agent, and that means those are always open options. And no matter how the evidence and the probability mounts in favor of their taking one option rather than the other, I continue to think of them, they could take the other as well. And if I stop thinking of them as agents, if I go to the objective stance, that's the only point at which I stop thinking in that way. In other words, to think of them as agents, as, so to speak, potential interactants with whom I can do business, as sometimes I like to use the word, as conversable, as someone I can reach across conversation and make a point about their not being, you know, that not being a good way to behave. If I continue to think of them that way, as most of us think of most others in that way, even those of us who do badly a lot of the time, we're idealizing all the time. So I think it's built into human interaction that we always lift the standards slightly higher than the actual performance warrants. We keep it up there, and we can, you have the capacity, we think. Now, if that's right, if a gentle idealization of that kind, the ascription of a capacity for any options to take one or the other, regardless of the actual inductive track record, so to speak, if that's right, then you can see why I can think of someone who is attached to me, but because I'm wealthy, I can think of them that, okay, there's now a possible scenario where, of course, they'll continue to gain my favor if they continue to be caring towards me, but, you know, they have the option of not being caring towards me. And now if I think of them, they can do that. I might think it's extraordinarily improbable that they do that, because, good God, they'd be cutting off their nose to spite their face. They'd be losing, you know, access to all my wealth and influence and so on. But I still, if I think of them as an agent, I think they can do that. That is something accessible to them. It may not be a probable choice, but it's an accessible choice. And if I think of them as an agent, then I've got to care about that still being perfectly accessible to them. Not to think, oh, I worry just about what they're likely to do. I don't worry about what they might do. Very, very unlikely. If I take that view, well, at that point, I've stopped thinking of them as an agent. Now they're not even worthy, so to speak, of my concern. They're like a probabilistic device, you know. So the idea is that if I think of the potential lover or friend as an agent for whom options are open, and I care about these various possibilities and how that person would behave towards me because it's part of being a friend, having loyal and faithful care for me, that in fact they should behave thus and so on, those possibilities, even though the wealth in itself might make it extremely likely that they will behave appropriately in those possibilities, still I worry that insofar as it's just wealth that might lead them to care, they can do something else. And the only way in which I can get their goodwill secure in the suitable measure is if I feel they've constrained their own will. They've constrained it from within. They've constrained it by loving me, by becoming a friend of mine. I have, so to speak, taken a place in their deliberations and motivations. So that's why I think we care about about loyalty and fidelity in this case, because we ascribe to other people, qua agents, a will, which is to say they can do this, they can do that, of various options, and that can is orthogonal to the probability of their taking any options. And so caring about what they can do, the only way in which I can secure what I want is that they should constrain themselves from within. That's why I think we care about loyalty and fidelity. And in caring about that, care about how things should be thus and so in various possible worlds. So that's basically the sort of line I take on why these particular examples of robustly demanding goods are actually desirable for us. I don't think what I've said is absolutely luminous and definitive and conclusive, as I'm sure you'll remind me in the discussion, but I sort of think something along those lines that I'm exploring has to be the right answer in explaining why these things are so desirable. But now another question is, okay, if these things are so desirable, someone's loyalty and someone's fidelity to me, my friends, my lover or whatever, then the question is, how does the person give me that particular good? And this is sort of an interesting question, because let's go back to the actualist good that's associated with the robustly demanding good of loyalty or fidelity. The actual good is care, right? Now, how do they give me care? Well, they give me care by what they do. Care is enactable. It's something you can do, right? You give the hand in moving the apartment. You help out in this or that scenario. You provide assistance, and so on. Care is enactable. It's a doable thing. But how do you, my friend, my lover, how do you deliver to me these goods that don't just boil down into actual goods? Because, of course, just behaving caringly towards me, that itself doesn't give me loyalty or doesn't give me fidelity. It just gives me care. And that's all action can provide in these cases is the actualist good of care. And as you think about that, clearly the way the person can give me these other goods is precisely by constraining themselves internally, precisely by having the virtue of loyalty or the virtue of fidelity. Now, there are many analyses of what it is to have the virtue of any virtue, but to have a virtue of loyalty or fidelity. But I assume that it's not just a tendency to give care, you know, which sort of sometimes is more reliable than others. Presumably, it's got to have some effect on how you deliberate, so that the loyal or the faithful friend or lover is, when it comes to think, when I make a request, things change, I need this help, and I ask, or it's just obvious, and there's a demand for care. The person who delivers loyalty and fidelity does so by virtue just of being the sort of person who, confronted with that demand, that call, does not, for example, well, calculate globally about what's best for the world overall. I mean, if someone calculated about, well, let me think about it, so Sunday morning you'd like me to have a movie pop. Well, of course, there are various other things I could do, and well, you know, that person can't give me fidelity or can't give me loyalty. Or if the person, you know, it's pretty clear that it's, you know, someone with a sort of sharp eye looking to number one and will only give me the care if it's, so to speak, in their interest, or, you know, it has very... Well, again, of course, they can't give me the good that I sought, which was this robust good of having their, well, robustly delivered care, robustly in the mode of fidelity and loyalty. So the only way they can actually give me the good that I so wish for, that I so want, so desire, is just by being a certain way, by having those virtues of loyalty or of fidelity. Just doing things won't do it, because doing things are still free of whatever the motives are. It's being virtuous, that's how they do it. Now, I sort of think this is, and of course I could enjoy someone's loyalty or fidelity, and I think that would still be a good, even if I didn't know that I enjoyed it. But of course, in these cases, we think of fidelity and loyalty as only been conscious fidelity and conscious loyalty of the other person. And, you know, if there really is loyalty and fidelity there, it's very likely that there will be evidence of it. And so I'll actually consciously enjoy this virtue as well as just enjoying it, period. But here's now what I want to say. This has got an interesting sort of lesson, hasn't it? Which is that, I mean, we're told in the literature about two ways in which virtue, at least two ways, in which virtue, so to speak, is really desirable, a great thing. In one way, we're told that, well, virtue, that's a very old thought, is that if someone is virtuous, they're more likely to do good, right? If someone is loyal, they're more likely to give me care. And care is good, we know that. So any probabilifier of care is good, okay? So that, so to speak, virtue is a means to... as a prompt to doing good. And that's one reason why virtue is attractive. A second reason why virtue may be attractive is the one that, say, John McDowell has given a lot of attention to in the past, and, of course, a range of other writers as well, some even present, well, quite rightly, I think, is that if you're virtuous, then not only are you more likely to do good, you're more likely to see what goodness requires, or in McDowell's terms, to see what virtue requires. So it's not only instrumentally or practically useful in prompting action, it's epistemically useful in priming, so to speak, insight into what good action, what would count as good action. But now, if what I've been saying is correct, then there's a third way in which virtue is really, really important, which is by being virtuous, you directly produce, in a way that you couldn't otherwise produce, a very distinctive good. You produce the robustly demanding good. By being virtuous, by being faithful, you give me the good that we describe by the same name as your fidelity. By being loyal, you give me the good that we describe as your loyalty. And those goods do not boil down, as I've been emphasizing, to care, anything that action could deliver. They are delivered, so to speak, in a mainlining way, as you might put it, by the very existence of the virtues. So virtues now are producing a distinctive good, these robustly demanding goods, because they're not produced by the action. And they're producing it in an indispensable way. I don't see any other way, things actually are as we as a species are and so on, in which we can get these goods from other people other than by their being virtuous. So I never thought I'd end up in this position, actually, and this brings me back to consequentialism in the last lecture, but I sort of think that this really undergirds a very powerful theory of virtue. Virtue is a means of producing a good that is otherwise unavailable, and it does it just by being there, so to speak. And it does it, of course, gives you the manifest good insofar as it's manifestly there. Okay, so that really brings me to the main line of argument in the paper. So what I want to do just now in concluding in the last five, possibly 10 minutes, is to try to generalize from these cases. So what I've been looking at, in order to try to get the structure as clear as I could in my own mind, I've been looking at what you might call bilateral virtues, virtues that involve two people, loyalty or fidelity. In fact, I've only been looking at it from one side, so there's been an extra simplification there, and I don't intend to unbracket that. But I want to, in order to remind you of the structure we've seen, I'd like you to look at the first two rows in the matrix, and the second on the back page of your handout. So if you look to the last column, you see fidelity. Now, how do I get fidelity? I get fidelity insofar as your response to me, to various calls or demands or needs on my part, your response to me, your response matches, go up a column, my interests over changes in my trades. As I grow older, as I lose the hairline and so on, as I change name, your response matches my interests over those changes as a result of not my being wealthy, but as a result of your virtue, the fact that you're constraining how you deliberate and behave towards me. And so, thereby, you robustly provide care. You provide care across a range of possibilities. And in robustly providing care, you actually provide a robustly demanding value, which is fidelity. And equally, your response matches my interests, if it does, over changes in your interest as a result of your virtue, so that you provide me with care robustly, then that's loyalty. Right? So you can see that in each case there's a response on your part, there's something on my part that it matches, there are various changes relevant, determining how robust it is. There's the entrencher of that behavior, as I call it, your virtue. And as far as your response matches my interests over those changes on that basis, the care you thereby provide robustly constitutes fidelity, or in the case where it changes over something different, your interest, it provides loyalty. Now, once you see that structure, you can see that certainly there are a lot of other bilateral virtues. Virtues, maybe. Let's look at the examples. You mightn't think them as virtues. They're meant to display the structure rather than to be, as it were, a sales pitch or anything for them. So, for example, someone enjoys somebody else's obedience, right? Used to be attritional virtue of, I don't know, I suppose servants or whatever. It seems now archaic. But in any case, second, somebody enjoys somebody else's obedience. Actually, it was what wives were supposed to provide, isn't it? To husbands, kind of thing. In a very archaic tradition, which obviously we all disavow. Obedience, in that case, your action has to match my order or my request, my word, over changes in, well, now notice, in what I might order. It isn't just that you do what I say, only when I say do X. Even if I say do Y, equally, over changes in what I request, your action has got to match my order, and of course also over changes in your interest in doing what I request you to do. And it has to be on the basis of your virtue. Now, if your action does match my orders over those changes in my orders and your interests on the basis of your virtue, then you deliver compliance with my orders in the actual world and a whole range of possible worlds, and thereby you provide me with obedience. Obedience is, again, a bilateral, robustly demanding value. Or look at another one I've just given here, which is, imagine the sense of being accepted by someone. you know, you're a stranger in Narnia, and you think, this person really come to accept me, I really treasure that. Well, if they accept me, what happens is that they welcome me, that's an actualist good, and they welcome me, their welcome matches just who I am, my identity. It's, you know, because it's Philip, he's welcome. And that's going to be true over changes in that person's interests in welcoming me, and over, indeed, what I may do within various boundaries, and that's as a result of their virtue, the way they constrain themselves. So that person gives me welcome robustly, and that's what we call giving me acceptance. So it should be straightforward, I think, why bilateral virtues other than fidelity or loyalty, you can work them out for yourselves, are going to very often have this structure. And why those virtues then are going to be, should be thought of as producers of a value or a good in themselves, and a very distinctive value or good. But the really interesting thing is that the structure also applies to, as you might call them, multilateral virtues. That's to say, virtues that aren't tied to a particular relationship. Just by way of background, think of the virtue of justice. And one very interesting characterization of justice by the Roman jurist Ulpian, which recurs in the Digest of Roman Law, Justinian's Digest, in which justice is described as consisting in a voluntas constans et perpetua, a will that is constant and enduring or perpetual, to give to others what is due to them, whatever their claims are under existing conventions or whatever. To be a just person on this account is to be someone, basically, who robustly delivers the satisfaction of the claims of others. But it has to be robust. Just to, so to speak, happen to satisfy the claims of others in a whole range of circumstances, whereas it's clear to an onlooker that, well, that was always in your interest. If you're going to count as a just person, it has to be that you would deliver that satisfaction, not just in those actual circumstances where, let's suppose, it's in your interest, but over a whole range of possible scenarios where it wasn't in your interest, and maybe where other people were less charming and so on. So, for example, as I put it here, your action, if you're going to be a just person in our midst, in relation to all of us in your society, then your action has got to match our claims on you, whatever they are thought to be. That's orthogonal. Over changes in those claims. I mean, they might be on one occasion one claim, another occasion another claim, but regardless of what they are, your actions have got to match our claims, and equally over changes in your interest in delivering that satisfaction. And this as a result of your virtue, your voluntas constans et perpetua, your perpetual and constant will. And only then do you count as just. And only then will you actually deliver the good to us that we enjoy insofar as we're dealing with a just person. The good that you get from living with a just person is not just the good that you get from their actually fulfilling your demands. That's a good too, or your claims. But they're robustly answering to those demands. That is a huge benefit, but a robustly demanding benefit, that they confer just in virtue of being just. Now, I should stop. It's pretty clear that what's true of justice is true in other cases too. So, for example, it's very good, it's very nice to be told the truth, even when it's not in the interest of the truth teller to tell you the truth. And we call a person honest when they robustly tell us they robustly give us answers that match the facts over changes in their interests. They robustly give us information over changes in their interests as a result of their virtue, not just because it happens to be opportunistically welcome. That's what it is for them to be honest, and their honesty we really enjoy over and above enjoying just the truth telling. Of course, there's also candor. A little bit like fidelity and loyalty. I mentioned it because candor isn't always so welcome. But what candor is, when the person tells you the truth, over changes in your interest, you might want to hear the truth, right? That's what it is to be candid. But again, it's a virtue which is robustly delivering a particular actualist good, truth telling, across a range of possibilities, those in which your interest in hearing the truth, as were the convenience of having the truth, varies. That's what it is to be candor. And similarly for courage and uprightness, you can see it here on the... it's very easy to work out. Indeed, work out other examples too. So that's it for this lecture. I'm thinking of the lecture as introducing the category of robustly demanding goods side by side with merely actualist goods. And these particular robustly demanding goods are delivered by the virtues. I think they're extraordinarily important in human life. And I think it gives us maybe an extra insight into how important virtue is to recognize the importance of these robustly demanding goods that are delivered by virtue. It turns out that there's a whole other category of robustly demanding goods that virtue won't deliver, that it takes law and external constraint to deliver. And that's what I'll be talking about tomorrow. So thank you very much.